Well, hello, everybody. This is Big Al, and this is Big Al's Community Chat every second and fourth Wednesday evening, listening for your pleasure. We're at, of course, WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, and we're streaming live at weft.org. And I'm glad to hear that you guys are out there listening. And tonight we have a very interesting guest, and I sort of met him on a ride. But tonight, Dr. Robert Jeffrey Trapp, and we call him Jeff. It's okay if I call you Jeff?
Absolutely.
Thank you. And Dr. Trapp is, of course, at the University of Illinois, and he's going to tell you his whole life story, how he got here and what's been happening with his life and his research here at the University of Illinois. But first, he has a B.S. in Agriculture and Atmospheric Science at the University of Missouri in Columbia, 1985. He then has his M.S. in Meteorology at the Texas A&M University in 1989. And then a Ph.D. in Meteorology at the University of Oklahoma in 1944. And so I want to welcome Dr. Trapp. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, great. Great to be here.
I know this is your first time on the radio, you told me, but I know that you have a hidden desire to be on this side of the microphone. Tell us a little bit about that before we get into your history.
So when I was a grad student back at Texas A&M, I made a demo tape to be on TV because one of my classmates was the weekend meteorologist, and I thought that would be a cool job to have. And so I made a demo tape, and it was awful, and that pretty much put an end to that dream.
Tell us a little bit how you arrived here at the university and why you decided to come to our home here in Champaign.
Yeah, sure. So I, as you said, I did my PhD at Oklahoma, and I had the great fortune to participate in a field campaign called Vortex back in the mid-90s, and essentially went from being a graduate student to being a scientist at one of the premier government labs in the country called the National Severe Storms Lab. It's in central Oklahoma. So I stayed there for a couple years, and then moved on to Boulder, Colorado, which is another premier lab called the National Center for Atmospheric Research. Was at NCAR for a few years, and then took a job at Purdue University, and was at Purdue for 11 years, and took a short drive from West Lafayette, Indiana, to Champaign, and now I'm here at the University of Illinois.
Why University of Illinois? Was there anything specific here that sort of attracted you to us?
Well, so first of all, I grew up in Illinois. I grew up in Belleville, so
I'm an Illinois native,
and so it's great for me to be back in the state because I haven't been here for such a long time, and I like to tell people that this is the first time since I graduated high school that I could potentially run into someone that I actually went to high school. But it's a great atmospheric science department, very active, lots of collaboration, lots of really interesting stuff. So it's a great fit for the kind of work that I do.
How big a undergraduates and how many professors do you have in this department?
Yeah, so we have I'm probably going to get the numbers wrong, but on order of 100 undergrads and about 50 graduate students and around 15 faculty, kind of roughly.
Okay, and they all want to be meteorologists, you think?
I think that's the question that all of our undergraduates get asked at least once in their lifetime, whether they want to be on TV. And there are some outstanding graduates that are on TV, but they all go off and do a number of different jobs, including forecasters in the Weather Service, and also go on to graduate school.
All right. Let's get into some of the interesting parts of your research and your study. And it's called the Department of Atmospheric Sciences. Give me an idea of a definition of what atmospheric sciences are.
Sure, it's pretty broad. So we have people who study how clouds form. My wife is a professor in the same department, and that's her expertise is trying to understand how clouds form and how clouds produce rain. So that's sort of one aspect. We have people who do climate, and I'm sort of included in that partly. We have people who are interested in the chemistry of the atmosphere. People who are interested in fronts and high-pressure systems and low-pressure systems, more of the traditional meteorology. And then people who are interested in the technology part of our field, weather radars, weather satellites, and how we use those to predict the weather.
So that sounds pretty interesting. Of course, sounds pretty intricate and complex. Your research is, one of your areas is called mesocale dynamics and storm structure. Okay, wait, before we go any further, you're going to have to, so what is mesocale?
So it's mesoscale. And it's,
mesoscale.
It's, sure. So it's sort of a length scale and a time scale that weather systems form. So thunderstorms, like the thunderstorms that went through.
Like we had here today.
That, absolutely. So those would be considered mesoscale. They last on the order of an hour, and they're of a size of, say, several counties, something like that. And so that kind of stuff that falls in that category is what really interests me.
So how, what are you looking for when you start this research? And are you looking for structure? Are you looking for how it forms? Are you telling me that there might be a way we can stop them, maybe in the future?
Not so much in production, but in understanding for sure, and also in prediction. Those are things that a lot of what we do in our department basically goes down to prediction, how we can predict whatever, tornadoes, severe thunderstorms better. And so that's at the heart of a lot of the work that we do. I'm interested in sort of all of the above. I'm interested in how these thunderstorms and other kinds of related weather systems form, how they do damage, how we can predict them better, and what we might expect in terms of their intensity in a future climate.
So how do they form? How do thunderstorms form?
So they're going to form from warm air. So like today, we went outside and it was very humid, and so that's the essential fuel for thunderstorms. And then there's some sort of mechanism that basically takes that warm, moist air and lifts it up into clouds. And lots of different ways. My students that are preparing for their final exam on Friday are working on this right now.
Are they listening here?
They should be studying.
They're not going to give many hints or anything.
They know what to study for.
Okay.
And so that lifting mechanism, sometimes it's a front, will basically produce clouds from the warm air, and then all the air motions within that basically allow for rain to form, and then everything goes downhill from there.
All right. So my wife is watching Ellen. Okay.
Okay.
And they break in. The meteorologist on Channel 3 breaks in, and they're talking about these thunderstorms coming through.
Sure.
Okay. Then they talk about this hook on the end of the thunderstorm. And they say there's convection and circulation. Give us an idea of what they're seeing when they see that kind of thing on the radar.
Sure. So I'll kind of step back, and that's one of the really important tools that we use right now is Doppler radar, because not only does it tell us something about the intensity of the storm when you see bright red, it's telling us that there's maybe hail in the storm and really heavy winds, but also it tells us the Doppler aspect of the radar tells us internal motions within the clouds, and we can interpret different patterns that basically are showing vortices. And so that's what this circulation, what a hook kind of structure in a cloud is basically telling, that there's rotation on the scale of, say, several miles, and that often, but not always, is the parent's rotation for a tornado.
So we have this heat rising.
Yeah.
And some are going to be all clouds and rain and lightning and maybe some hail, but the tornado is a very unique aberration, I guess, of this cloud. Why some clouds have it and some clouds don't?
Sure. So they have to form in a really special set of circumstances. We call them ingredients. And so one of the ingredients we already talked about, lots of warm, moist air. But another really important ingredient is what the wind does from the ground up to, say, 6 miles above the ground.
Oh, wow.
And so it's important for us to know that the wind is increasing in speed from distance above the ground, but it also changes directions. And when we have that kind of condition, that often is basically converted into the storm rotation that we just talked about. And it's a very kind of specific set of conditions.
Well, it seems like there's an awful lot of those specific set of conditions happening more and more frequently, especially the intensity of them. Is there any particular reason why we're seeing many more intense storms, much more these hailstones that are coming down now? They're looking like softballs instead of pebbles. What is the is there an exterior emphasis on what's happening?
So it's one of the active research projects within my group at the university, thinking about intensities of thunderstorms in today's climate as well as in the future climate. And so we sort of break it down into this wind characteristic. So how strongly the wind is increasing in speed and how much it's changing in direction with distance above the ground. And also we sort of talk about an energy, a fuel, and it's related to basically how cold it gets with distance above the ground as well as how much moisture there is. And we're trying to evaluate sort of in a long-term trend whether or not that fuel is increasing and by how much and where as well.
That's something a lot to think about.
It is. That's right.
So there are other areas that I wanted to, you have so much research. I've been looking up on your the website and on what the University of Illinois offers of these undergraduates, and there's convective storms is another one of your research areas. I know what a storm is. What's a convective storm?
So a thunderstorm is a convective storm. Any type of storm, when we look outside, like yesterday, great example, and today as well, when we see these billowing clouds, that's a convective storm. And it's forming because the air is just really buoyant. And so we're interested in sort of the internal workings of the storms, the question that you asked, why some of those end up producing tornadoes, why some don't produce tornadoes but end up producing really long swaths of damaging winds. That's a really important question for us. It's an important question for a weather service forecaster trying to understand those. And so that's the kind of work that I do.
So do you associate with some of the meteorologists locally here? Do you work with them at all? Do they look to you for some research or some help when they're reading their Doppler radar?
So not necessarily in real time, but I have had a number of interactions with the National Weather Service folks in Lincoln. I go down there maybe once every twice a year, maybe more often, to kind of share with them some of my latest research. And also hear their problems as well. That's really important for me to know what they're struggling with and if there's some kind of research that I can incorporate in what I'm doing right now that might help them.
Can you expand on that? What would they be asking of you to answer their questions?
Sure. Well, so today's weather is a perfect example of this. The storm system that went through us around 4 o'clock this afternoon is called a bow echo. And it's the type of research that I've been working on for more than 10 years. And I'm interested in not only how bow echoes cause damage, which they did, but also why some cause tornadoes and why some of them don't. And that's a kind of an equally important question. So I'll go back and take some of the data that they've collected, try to interpret that, and then also include it in with other types of tools that I use, including computer programs that simulate the weather, and try to understand, again, why some of these bow echoes, like what we saw today, why some of them are damaging and why some of them aren't. And then I share that kind of work with them.
So it's a collusion, not a collusion, it's an association between National Weather, the meteorologists on TV that you see that break in with these warnings. But Doppler radar, who invented Doppler radar? Because I hear that it made a tremendous difference in how you look at a storm.
It sure has. So what's interesting is it's kind of a fluke in how sort of that technology has sort of made its way into weather forecasting. And it started with, if I have the story right, it basically started with some military operations and some of the military folks who are using radars for military purposes noticed that they got a change in the frequency of a signal that they transmitted, and that sort of led to the development of radar. But this has been ongoing for a long time. I mentioned my affiliation with this lab in Norman, Oklahoma. And so back
Us a little bit about
that. Back in the 70s, this is something that they were really keen on doing, is trying to find a way to use this capability, which basically senses motions of individual raindrops and hailstones, and trying to figure out how that information can be used to better predict the weather.
Interesting stuff. I remember when I was a kid, there was a lot of talk about seeding clouds. I'm not sure if I remember exactly. I don't think they're doing it anymore, or are they doing
it? No, they absolutely are. Yeah. So
tell me about that.
Yeah. So there's a couple different approaches to doing this. Some people are seeding it to make rain. There are some groups that are seeding clouds to reduce hail, which is a good thing. There are some groups that attempt to introduce material into clouds to make them snow more. So you can imagine that a ski slope, they may be interested in trying to do that. One of the implications of this is, of course, is that if you're in one location and you seed the cloud and you produce rain, then it may mean that the cloud doesn't rain kind of downwind from you. And so there's these kind of unintended consequences that I think are making that type of work sort of difficult to justify at times.
So,
but it's really interesting.
I guess there are different types of seeding. Is that what it is? I mean, if you want to form for rain, that's one type of. What do you go about? You fly into it. You drop what?
Yeah. So this is not exactly my research area.
Okay.
This is more my wife's.
But you got me on this track
now. This is more my wife's research
area. Oh, is it really? I should have had her here.
Yeah. Silver iodide is one example. She's probably cringing right now. I'm not getting this right, but
don't cringe now. Don't cringe.
Some of this work is done from the ground, from flares. Some of it's done literally from aircraft that fly through the clouds and dump it into the clouds. But again, it's one of the difficult things that we have in meteorology and atmospheric science is proving that what we did as seeding as an example made a difference, because we don't have a control. It's not like us being in a chemistry lab where we're mixing two things together and we get an outcome, and then we mix two different things together and we get a different outcome. So we don't have that control because nature is our laboratory.
So you must do some kind of modeling. Within the research, what type of modeling is there, and how do you go about putting that together so you can come to a conclusion?
Sure, that's a really important component of my research, and it turns out that Illinois is a great place to do this.
Is
because
it?
Of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, and there's big supercomputer called Blue Waters.
Right, that's just over here on Oak Street.
That figures prominently in my work, and it turns out also that this department has a long history of producing fairly renowned scientists who made significant discoveries.
You mean like yourself?
Well, I wouldn't even consider myself on that same level with some of these people, but Bob Wilhelmsen, who's a professor emeritus in our department, made significant discoveries on how tornadic thunderstorms work using models. And the model is just basically a really long computer program, and it's based on equations that we know govern motions in the atmosphere, and they're coded up. And I said that one of the difficulties that we have in our field is lack of control, but that these models allow us to do that, because basically what we can do is do experiments where one experiment we choose to include something and another experiment we choose to exclude it, and we look at the difference. And so we could do the same thing with simulations of thunderstorms, and we've done that quite a bit.
I know. We're very lucky to have the university here, and it's all that equipment and technology that they have. I saw them put up Blue Waters. I've been here a long time in Champaign and watched the growth of the university, and seeing that we're one of the top universities in that area in the country, and it's a testament to you to have you as one of our own, so to speak, here at the university. Is your wife also from Belmont? Where did you meet your wife? Let's talk about the professor herself.
Yeah, so lots of ironies here. So she grew up in southern Indiana. She went for her bachelor's degree at St. Louis University, which is right across the river from where I grew up. My dad is an alumnus of St. Louis University and really wanted me to go there, but I didn't want to. I wanted to go to Mizzou instead. Had I gone to St. Louis U, I probably would have met my wife, Sonia, there. But we didn't actually meet until we were both graduate students in Oklahoma.
I see.
And she was a new master's student, and I was a PhD student, and we shared lots of common interests. And almost 25 years later, here we are.
That's fantastic. It's great to have someone who understands what you're doing.
It sure is.
And vice versa.
On multiple levels. I know that our kids roll their eyes often when we're talking about departmental politics, but we also try to
talk. You mean there's politics at the University of Illinois? Please, Jeff, you know. Okay, let's not get into. We are not going to get you in trouble here.
We'll
promise.
We'll focus on science.
Yes,
but we do try to do that, and in fact, we're collaborating on a project right now, which is really cool because it's something that we can talk about. But I will
say
that.
Can you talk about it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so we're kind of going back to convective storms, thunderstorms. We're really interested in how we can predict storms better, and we have kind of an issue with these prediction models. Again, these are just big, long computer programs. But some of these models are really coarse. The analogy that I have is sort of like what the camera was like on your phone 10 years ago. Really coarse, really blotchy, compared to what it is right now, mm-hmm. where you can really see lots of fine details. And so the models are like that. And especially the models that we apply to look at processes over the climate. Climate models are like that. They're like the digital cameras of 10 years ago. And so we're trying to figure out ways of being able to use information about clouds to basically help these models make rainfall better.
Stop right there. Why would you want to make rainfall, you mean better? In what way?
So more accurate.
Oh, okay.
It turns out that these models have a problem, kind of struggle with producing accurate precipitation, especially in certain times of the year in the summer, just because those thunderstorms are pretty small in scale. They're the scale of counties, and that's below that 1 megapixel effective resolution of a climate model. And so we're trying to find ways of introducing new information, new ways of representing different processes to make the models more accurate.
In my past careers, I was part of the Illinois Farm Bureau, and I'm assuming that do they work with you on hoping maybe to predict some rain in August when they need it?
So there's a lot of interaction with some people in my department and folks in agriculture and thinking about seasonal predictions. They're really keen on getting any information they can on it. It's an interest of mine trying to find what there is in the atmosphere and kind of the atmosphere system that may give us clues on what the rainfall will be over the season, what the temperatures will be over the season. And for me, one of the things that we're really interested in is knowing what the severe weather activity may be over a particular season.
You mean you don't open up the Farmer's Almanac and it doesn't tell you?
So my in-laws like to poke fun at me about that. And
do they?
I've gotten a number of issues of the Farmer's Almanac for Christmas presents, but I don't know that there's anything in there about tornadoes. And in fact, it turns out that there is no official seasonal prediction of tornadoes like there is with hurricanes. And it's so something that we're
That's
working on.
That's another thing
right
we're going to go into here in a minute. Obviously, you cannot predict a tornado. Or can you predict a tornado? But I'm assuming that there has to be the right ingredients and the right things that come together for a tornado, as we talked about. But we know they seem to be able to say that, well, there's going to be 6 named tropical storms, 7 hurricanes, and 15 other. But how do they, and then do they get it right? They have all these names ready for these all these hurricanes. But to me, it sounds a little presumptuous in my mind that you're already telling me that there's going to be this season 7 hurricanes?
So the same kind of approaches that they use are approaches that we're trying to consider for severe weather predictions. And some of them are based on these models, these computer programs.
Yeah.
Some of them are based on conditions in different parts of the world. So we're really, really interested in the temperature of the ocean, especially in the tropics.
Right.
And we look in certain regions within the tropics and try to determine whether or not the temperature is really warm or not. Maybe how that relates to something like El Nino. So we've experienced a really strong El Nino over the past.
Yeah, we didn't have very much of a winter here.
We did not, yeah. And so that's one contribution. And so a seasonal forecaster would look at that. And I have some colleagues that are looking at El Nino versus La Nina and what that might mean for seasons within severe weather. We have our focus in different parts of the globe to try to determine whether or not that tells us something about the season, but there are some hints in what we consider to be slow processes like the ocean temperatures that could potentially tell us how that would relate to a season in severe weather activity.
So we see recently, and it seems to be almost every other day, Texas has these terrible storms. And the storm's intensity is so bad and so lengthy that the floods continue. And they have these flooding in southern states, and then you have flooding along the coast. And then you hear in Europe and in Asia the floods there. Can we predict the future of what's going to happen as the ice caps, which are melting, and I see the pictures.
Yeah, you're correct.
I see the pictures. Yeah. Is that cooling the water overall, or because in the tropics it has to be a certain warmth for you to cause a hurricane? Correct.
Right.
But will that? Answer my question, please.
Sure. Yeah. So we can.
I'm getting my tongue tied here.
That's right. So we can separate out flooding from hurricanes and tropical cyclones from just flooding from weather systems, and it's the latter that I'm probably more interested in. But it's a challenge because. If anyone's ever looked at maybe a radar app that they have on their phone on some
sure.
days, getting tremendous amounts of rainfall from one little blip on your radar app, and those are the really challenging things. So we have some skill in predicting sort of current day amounts of rainfall, but one of the challenges that we have are trying to sort of separate out. Extreme rainfall that falls within a 12-hour period from extreme rainfall that falls over a week. And incidentally, that's one of the things that really got me interested in climate, because I remember reading increases in extreme rainfall and trying to figure out what the heck they were talking about in extreme rainfall. And it turned out not to be what I think about extreme rainfall, which is what we had today.
Right. You have other areas like climate processes and interactions. Of course, you're going to explain that to me, aren't you, Jeff?
Sure. Yeah. So here's an example.
And excuse me, Jeff. I do have to take a quick break.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No problem.
Hang on to that thought.
Will do. Yeah.
Okay. We are WEFT 90.1 FM here in Champaign, and we stream live at weft.org. And I'm speaking with Professor. Robert Jeffrey Trapp here from the Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois. He is one of our scientists who are going to help us understand what rainfall, clouds, tornadoes, hurricanes, and all those things that we fear that are hopefully going to stay away from Champaign. Let's move on to the climate processes and interreactions, Jeff, please.
Sure. So here's just one example and some things that I'm really interested in right now. I just read a paper yesterday on irrigation and how irrigation over large areas could actually reduce the rainfall over that same area, but then increase the rainfall downwind. And So maybe that sounds counterintuitive, but there's some physical explanations that we can use to talk about these. But the bottom line is that there's so many interactions between things that go on with the land, that interact with the atmosphere, processes that are happening within the ocean are interacting with the atmosphere. There's lots of interactions between the ice and snow and in the atmosphere. And so getting all these sorted out is a big challenge for us. And it's really what makes my life, really interesting and scientifically anyway.
Yes. I'll tell you, there's a lot to learn. Okay, let's get to the nitty-gritty, okay? Everybody talks about climate change.
Sure.
Everybody talks about the science that is coming out of science areas everywhere. The ice caps are melting. The climate, the temperatures are rising. And we've seen that here in Champaign over the last 4 or 5 years. We seem to break records month after month. I mean, January, walking around short sleeves is not something I'm normally used to, though I can get used to it. It would be nice.
Right.
Let's have a little conversation about climate and climate change and how your area might be able to help us in understanding more about it.
Sure. Well, it's interesting, Al, because we met, I think, just a few days before I had this experience. And this was back in January, MLK Day. I was at a store, and people may or may not remember, but it was really cold on day. 10 degrees was a high, 0 degrees was the low. And I was walking out of the store, and there's a gentleman that was passing my way going into the store, and he looked at me and he said, "Global warming, my foot." He actually didn't say foot, but you get the point.
Of course.
And I just chuckled and I was stunned, because I'm thinking later that obviously this person did not remember that just a few days before the temperature was 52 degrees. And as you just mentioned, December was incredibly warm. December 23rd, 62 degrees high for here. I think there were 6 days of 60 degrees in December. So one of the things that I think that we're failing to do right now is communicating what climate change means. And so I think I have one way of at least addressing temperature, if you allow me.
Please.
All right. So
I've got another half hour.
So I've been thinking about this a lot, and this actually really bothered me, this encounter, and I think one of the issues, one of the stumbling points that people have is temperature, and in fact that term global warming, because when I think about that, I think it's going to be warm all the time.
Right.
And it turns out that we will have fluctuations in temperature just like we have fluctuations right now. But here's my analogy. So I picture my niece or my daughter, 5 years old, on a teeter-totter or seesaw. I call them teeter-totters. And so the little girl has short legs, and so she's going up and down on the teeter-totter and the seesaw. And when she goes up and down, sometimes she's able to get a little boost of energy and get that seesaw up high, and then sometimes not. So that's like the temperature. It's going up and down. Sometimes we have warm days. Sometimes we have not so warm days. Today was a warm day. Yesterday wasn't as warm. So now let's let your niece or your daughter grow up to 15. So now she has longer legs, more powerful. She's on the same teeter-totter, but now she's able to spring up a lot higher. And because she has long legs, she's not bottoming out as much. And so kind of this is sort of like the future climate. Lots of days where she's getting higher, the temperature is higher, fewer days where she's getting lower to the ground. In other words, the temperature's not dropping down as much as it was before. So that's the type of fluctuation that we're going to see in the future climate. Fewer colder days, more warm days, but still lots of fluctuations. And so we can't assume that it's just going to be warm. We're still going to have highs and lows. We're still going to have periods where it's colder. We're going to have periods where it's warmer, but kind of on the trend, it's going to be warmer. Yeah.
Yeah. That's an interesting analogy. I really like that. It easily explained to some people out there that, are you listening? We have climate change. I don't know about global warming, but it seems that more and more areas of the world are flooding much more easily.
Right.
And I would say about 70% or 60 or 80% of our, between 60 and 80% of our economy and our cities are on coastlines. New York, Miami, Dallas, you know, the Texas, El Paso, down the New Orleans, mm-hmm. San Francisco, my son who lives in Los Angeles. These are all major areas that are going to be, have to be affected by the rise in the seawater. What can we do about that? Can we do anything? Well, what is the answer? Is there an answer?
So there are obviously actions that we can take. Reducing our output of fossil fuels obviously is a key one. I think we all try to do these kinds of things. We all try to drive more fuel efficient cars. We try to use public transportation. We try to say cut down on maybe how much we run our air conditionings and so on. But it's going to take a global effort to have any effect at all.
Well, so I've been hearing not too great scenarios about what's taking place, that we're on the precipice, that if we don't take major action quickly, it may be too late. Too late meaning unlivable, too late in not my lifetime, obviously, but my grandchildren. They're 7 years old and 6 years old. What's going to happen in 30, 35, 40, 50 years from there?
Right. That's a great question. I think one of the challenges that we have when we think about climate change is to how to project this out in the future.
Right.
And essentially what we do is there's sort of two ways to do it. We can essentially take the record of temperature or whatever over the past and try to extend it out to the future. So that's one way. And the other way is to use these models, these computer programs. One of the things that we have to do is essentially guess what the conditions are going to be like in the future. And we do these through what are known as greenhouse gas scenarios, or now what's more formally called representative concentration pathways, or RCPs. So essentially
you're going to go back on
So essentially what people do, what scientists do, is they try to estimate what the population is going to be, what the use of fossil fuels are going to be, and try to predict in the future what the greenhouse gas concentrations of carbon dioxide, concentrations of methane, what they're going to be like in 50 to 100 years. And then we use that as input to our computer programs.
Sounds interesting. I'm not sure if we have. No, we don't. We just are looking for my next question for you here. Integrated assessment of climate change. How is that different than weather and climate change, or is it?
So the assessment is all about trying to figure out the impacts. And so here's an example. So I have a student that is working on hurricanes, and so she's really interested in what hurricanes do when they make landfall and the hazards that they cause. So she's really interested in the tornadoes that some hurricanes that make landfall they form, and as well as the flooding, and especially the inland hazards. And so you can imagine the type of impact that increases in hurricane-induced tornadoes, increases in the hurricane-induced flooding, what that would mean to evacuations. And so she's trying to figure that out. What would happen if a hurricane like Ivan, which ended up producing a lot of tornadoes, what would happen if that occurred again in another 20 years and produced twice the number of tornadoes? What would happen if we had another Katrina that produced twice the amount of flooding? And so thinking about those impacts and then thinking about what that means for evacuation, that's the kind of assessment that we try to do. And it involves thinking about not just the science, but also the human side, which is really interesting.
Yes, because I do remember what happened with Katrina. Those people stuck at the stadium with no help whatsoever, and there's nowhere to go.
Right.
I won't get into the politics of that. Obviously, there was a lot of mistakes made. But the key was that it wasn't predicted, if I remember correctly, to be that devastating? Or was it because they just weren't prepared enough for Katrina?
Well, I think there's blame to go around, and plenty of blame to spread around. But I think it was unprecedented. And so it's hard for us to sort of think outside the box in that way, that this is something that couldn't happen. And now that it has happened, I'm hoping that we have learned from that, and that we can transfer kind of new understandings about this type of work that my student is doing in keeping this from happening again.
I noticed there is a research area in satellite and radar remote sensing. Is that Doppler radar, or is that something
so
different?
It's both. So we use we call them remote because literally the thing that's doing this sensing, the thing, either the satellite, which is in space, or the radar, which is on the ground someplace, is giving us information at some distance from whatever, from the phenomenon, from the thunderstorm. And it's a safe way for us to, at least for tornadoes, to get information about tornadoes at some safe distance, as opposed to driving through it or doing something hazardous like that. And so one of the things that I'm really interested in is how we can use Doppler radars to estimate potential intensities of tornadoes even before they formed. And so what we've been able to find is that when we look at Doppler radar, if it has strong motions, that most often that's represented in a strong tornado. So not only can we use this tool to anticipate the formation of the tornado, but also anticipate whether or not the tornado is strong or not, because it turns out that's a really important question.
Sure.
To answer in real time. Do these people really need to get out of the way, or is it something that sheltering in their basement is going to be okay? And so it's a question that we struggle with.
Well, that's a serious question, obviously. Life or death in some cases. The tornadoes this past couple of days in the South, and even here in Illinois, it just seems that I'm hoping that one day we're able not only to predict them, but able to put a halt to them. I never put anything past science fiction, because science fiction today is science fact tomorrow, and we've seen that happen over and over and over again. Automobiles running by themselves, and to the moon and onward, and I'm not surprised. In all my lifetime, I've seen cell phones and I've seen computers and
sure.
things that I've never seen before
sure.
Come to fruition. Do you think that there's a possibility that with all of this modeling and research, that like we seed clouds to do something, is there a way to seed clouds to stop doing something?
So there have been people that have proposed things. I don't get as many phone calls as I used to, but often they involve large weapons being launched into the storm, and with the idea that it disrupts the processes or whatever that are going on. But the problem is that if your house happens to be underneath the bomb that was dropped into the storm, then you suffer just as much damage. But I will say that.
Yeah, but one house compared to a whole city.
Well, that's right. But one of the directions that we're heading is trying to figure out if it's possible to give more than, say, 15 minutes of advance warning. And it might be that we're able to give 2 hours of advance warning.
Oh, wow.
Or an hour of advance warning or something like that.
You can evacuate by then.
We actually don't know what the perfect time is, because
right.
If you're like me and probably lots of people, you're going to wait until the very last minute. For me, because I have a sort of a vested interest in knowing what's happening. But we don't exactly know what the perfect time is. But lots of work in my group, as well as across the world, in trying to figure out how we can use all the information that we have, all the data, Doppler radar, satellites, all the temperature and humidity information that we collect near the ground, put these into the models and run these models at a high digital camera kind of resolution, and use this to essentially issue warnings based on these forecasts. And literally, this is the concept that's called Warn on Forecast. And lots of work that's being done at this national lab in Norman, the National Severe Storms Lab, and it's pervading lots of research labs around the country. And so it's pretty exciting.
Have you ever chased tornadoes?
Yeah.
Oh,
in fact,
tell me.
So,
of course, I'm thinking of that movie
Twister?
Twister.
Yeah,
that showed them looking up inside the toilet. Now, I don't know if that's possible,
I've never done that, and I would not advise being in the machine shed with lots of sharp objects flying around. But yeah, in fact, my wife Sonia and I, when we were grad students at Oklahoma, that's what we did for dates.
Did you?
For dates.
Now, that's unusual.
Yeah. At the end of the day, we ended up having dinner at the truck stop or something like
that. Well, I want to meet your wife.
but actually, the really cool thing for us as meteorologists, students of meteorology, is that we're out there. We're making forecasts to try to see if we can predict where the storms are going to form. And then we're out in the field observing them. We're learning a lot about the structure. We're learning about how they form visually. And it was a great learning experience for us as well.
Wow. That must have been fairly exciting. But what if you're going in the wrong direction?
Well, so I will say that...
Is there predictability to the movement of a tornado so that you don't put yourself in harm's way?
There absolutely is, yeah. And it's based on what the winds are doing with distance above the ground, how fast they're blowing, sort of what directions they're blowing. And often we see winds at, say, 3 miles above the ground that are blowing from the southwest. And so that wind sort of at least helps steer the clouds in that direction. But we know that going into it. We know essentially what the expected motion of the storms are going to be based on the information that we collect from weather balloons and so on.
So in Twister, she had this machine.
Right.
That had all these little
like
gadgets.
Golf balls.
That they wanted to fly up inside the tornado.
Sure.
And take statistical... statistics
sure.
of the tornado. Is that true, or is that just something that they have decided?
So it's a pretty interesting idea. So in the movie, it was called Dorothy.
Right,
And Dorothy was actually based on something that was called TOTO. And TOTO stands for Totable Tornado Observatory. And it looked something like that, except that it didn't have all the ping pong balls, but instead it had an instrument to measure the wind. It had instruments to measure temperature and humidity. And the idea was that this thing called TOTO was deployed in the path of a tornado, and the tornado would pick it up, and it would be collecting data as it was going into the tornado, and then they would go back and retrieve it. Problem is that it wasn't very successful because this thing, which was like a 55-gallon drum, was really, really heavy, which was really hard to deploy and get into the path of the tornado. And get out of the way for sure. And often what happened, from what I understand anyway, is that the wind just knocked it over. But the basic idea of deploying instruments in the path of tornadoes is something we've been doing now for more than 20 years, and it's provided us information about what the temperature and pressure and humidity do near the ground with a tornado passage. But what we've really used a lot is Doppler radars. Besides the big Doppler radars that the National Weather Service has, as well as what a lot of the TV stations have, we now have the technology to basically put these radars on the back of trucks.
Oh, wow.
In fact, some of the listeners may have seen a mobile radar that's called the DOW, the Doppler on Wheels radar, that we had on campus here near the beginning of the semester. And it was something that the students used, and one of our faculty had it in her class. And so the idea is that this radar is moved close to the tornado, but obviously not inside the tornado, and it's scanning back and forth, and it's collecting information about raindrops, pieces of debris kind of moving towards the radar and away from the radar.
Cows and trucks.
Well,
and all
right. We don't want to see that. But we're keeping a safe distance. But so the basic idea about Twister, trying to understand the internal motions within the tornado, this is what we've been doing with these mobile radars.
So you thought that there was something educational about Twister.
So Twister was actually was interesting because I mentioned at the beginning of the show that right when I finished my graduate degree at Oklahoma, I start this field campaign called Vortex. And this is exactly at the same time that Twister was being filmed. And in fact, there was set that had been built in Norman, Oklahoma, really close to the National Severe Storms Lab. So we had the opportunity to interact with some of the actors. Bill Paxton, who was the lead guy,
right.
I had the opportunity to chase with one day.
Did you?
I did, yeah. One day, and I'm embarrassed to say that I didn't know who he was at the time.
Oh, really?
One of our guys said, hey, there's this guy from Hollywood. He wants to ride along with you. Is that okay? I said, yeah, whatever. And so I told him to sit in the back and not bother us. And but he was great. He was a lot of fun. He actually really wanted to learn what we did. And so the whole time he was imitating our radio protocol with his microphone and kind of taking notes and interacting with us. And it turned out that on that day we ended up chasing in a part of Texas where he grew up. And he hadn't been back in that part of Texas since he graduated high school and left for Hollywood. And so that was actually a really cool experience. So when the movie came out, I was really nervous that he would do something or say something that was so blatantly wrong and everyone would blame me for educating him in the wrong way.
So he didn't.
He was pretty good, except for the scene where he, I guess, took a handful of dust and dropped it and used that to estimate the direction of the wind. We don't do that.
You know, well, that's pretty interesting. I didn't think we were going to get to Hollywood here.
Yeah, that was a fun experience.
Well, where else can we go that we can educate our listeners on what you do? Now, your students, obviously. They have the same kind of ambition to learn about storms.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about actuality. What happens inside your classroom?
Sure. So inside the classroom as well as inside my research group, my research lab, we have a pretty wide variety of research interests, but. Because they're working with me, they have a severe weather interest. And I try to give my students an opportunity to do field work. One of my current students has done that to an extent. I actually have a couple students that I left back at Purdue before I came to Illinois that were with me out in the field a couple years ago for 4 weeks releasing weather balloons around storms. And so it's a great opportunity, as I said before, when we were graduate students learning firsthand about the weather and how storms form and how they evolve. It's a really important opportunity. We're planning a field campaign right now for Argentina. One of my colleagues is leading this effort, and it's going to be a great opportunity for us to go and experience some of the strongest storms in the world and understand.
Argentina?
It's one of the questions that we hope to answer is why there. We have some ideas, and it's related to topography and proximity to the Amazon. Those are some of the ideas, but to actually go in the field and deploy instruments and make measurements and try to understand better why these storms are doing what they do.
So your wife is a partner, so to speak.
Yes.
She's in the same not in the same research. What is her expertise?
So her expertise is in a field called cloud physics. And so she's really interested in sort of the small scale details within the clouds, individual raindrops. She wants to know how individual raindrops or cloud drops are going to collide to form raindrops and how they can basically go from relatively small drops to big drops in a short period of time. She wants to know what the effect of air that's mixed into the clouds, what effect that has on either slowing this process or speeding it up and perhaps even killing the cloud in general. So kind of the small scale details of clouds.
Wow. That sounds very complex.
It's really interesting, and so she spends a significant amount of her time doing field work. She did a field camp the same year that I did field work throughout the U.S. looking at launching weather balloons around storms in the center part of the U.S. I came back, and within a week she was gone for a field campaign in England, studying rainfall in England. And she, before that, was doing some field work in parts of the tropics. And so her field deployments are typically a lot more exotic than mine, because mine are usually in places like, which are great places in the country, but just not as exotic.
I was just going to say, tropical sounds very nice.
That's right.
I see part of your research is tropical meteorology and hurricanes. Does that mean you go to Hawaii to check them out?
I wish. And most of that is more within one of my students and her interest in trying to figure out how they produce tornadoes and flash flooding once they make landfall. But yeah, I wish that I had a deployment in Hawaii. That would be a lot of fun.
Wow. Well, I this hour has gone very, very quickly. We're almost done here, Jeff. I keep thinking I want to call you Robert, but you'll like to be called by your middle name,
not
Jeff.
A problem.
We've been listening to Dr. Robert Jeffrey Trapp from the University of Illinois and atmospheric science. It's been a very interesting learning experience here right now, Doc, and I want to thank you for coming in. Is there anything that you can say in a positive way that the future will look better than us frying at 150 degrees in 25 years?
Yeah, so I don't think we're going to be flying. We're not going to be frying at 150 degrees in 25 years. I think we'll see a more gradual increase in temperatures, and we're going to see a gradual increase in things like numbers of frost-free days. And so there are some aspects that will be beneficial and some aspects that won't be so beneficial. And so what we have to do is adapt, and I think that's kind of one of the biggest things that the people can start to do besides taking actions to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions is to figure out how they're going to adapt.
Well, I know that President Obama has just come back from I think it was 150 countries that all signed on to do just that. Hopefully that'll make a difference in our future for our children and grandchildren. And I just hope that we learn a lesson from the past for our future. We've been listening to Dr. Robert Trapp here on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign. Doctor, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
We're going to close with promotional things here that I have to do to close up my show tonight. Look for Big Al's Community Chat 2 weeks from tonight. I'm not sure who your guest is going to be, but I promise it's going to be a lively discussion. Robert, Jeff, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, sir.
And hope to see you down the road.
All right, likewise.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Dr. Robert Trapp from the University of Illinois Atmospheric Sciences. I hope you learned something about climate control, as I have, and I'm hoping that what he says is true, that we'll be able to adapt one day, and perhaps our grandchildren will be able to live a safer life. So let me give you a last little promotion here. Motor vehicle donation to WEFT. In just 10 minutes, you can make arrangements to donate your car or recreational vehicle to WEFT. Running or not, as long as you have the title, the Center for Car Donations will arrange a free tow when you call 877-411-3662. They do the paperwork, you get a tax write-off, and help keep WEFT programming on the air. Call 877-411-3662 to donate your vehicle to WEFT Community Radio. That's 877-411-3662. Thank you all, and have a great evening.
and you're listening to WEFT 90.1 FM Champaign, streaming online at weft.org. I'm your host for the next hour, Mara. You're listening to Sync Sound System, some electronic beats and bass for your earwaves. Thanks for tuning in. Tonight we are going to play some dank beats and things to get you really moving. And yeah, it's going to be a good show. Playing a lot of new stuff. Artists who actually, some of whom I have seen recently in my travels down south. And I'm really excited to play some of this for you all. All right, so without further ado, let's hear some electronic beats. All right. Let's see, queuing it up right now. We are about to hear one from Opio, who is playing in Chicago on Friday night. And it's at the Mid. It's O-P-I-U-O, Opio. And we're about to hear one called Sneakers. Check it out. Here's Opio. right. Right there we heard Space Jesus featuring Digital Vagabond. That was Jovian Chorus. And that was just posted a few weeks ago up on their Facebook and SoundCloud. You can check them out. Space Jesus on Zoned Volume 1 and Sounds of Wakan. And you can buy that one at Beatport, iTunes, and listen on Spotify as well. Before that, we started off the set with Opio Speakers. Again, Opio is playing in Chicago this week, Friday night. Did you know that WEFT has a YouTube channel? We do, and you can check it out at youtube.com/WEFT901FM, 90.1 our station. You can also visit our website, and there is a link. We currently have 100 videos from our WEF sessions, videos from fundraisers at the Iron Post, links to the Prairie Monk, and a view of WEF from the 1990s when the station was just over 10 years old. The station is over 30 now. We're adding new videos all the time, so check them out and let us know what you think. Also, speaking of letting us know what you think, we are currently conducting a survey of our listeners. You can go to the WEFT.org homepage and click on the link to take the two-minute survey. We appreciate your feedback. All right, so give us a shout. Let us know what you think, and you can check out our YouTube in sum. All right, next up, we are going to hear one that I just discovered this week. Another weird one, which weird is good, right? And this one is Spoonbill with Moon Swagger. Check it out. After that, we're going to hear one from Globular, kind of a sweet, more down-tempo tune. All right, here's Spoonbill. Thanks for listening to WEFT Champagne.
Thank you.
was Globular with Emergent Resurgence off of their new Holobiont album. He is out of Bristol in the United Kingdom, and he just released a really sweet new album. All the songs are at least 7 minutes long, really great stuff. You can check that out on his Bandcamp page and listen to more Globular Bofree. And before that, we heard some Spoonbill with Moon Swagger. And Spoonbill he's been around since about 2005. He released an album back then. He's got a handful of albums, and he's from Australia. And before that, we heard Space Jesus, who is from Brooklyn. He's off of, Gravitas Recordings label. Coming up, we are going to hear one of my favorites and a person very special in the bass music community who recently threw his own amazing festival down in Florida on the full moon a few weeks ago in northern Florida. I was there. It was awesome. And his name is Dave Tipper. We're going to hear two songs here. First, a little more down-tempo one called The Re-Up, and going into one of his new release EPs, and it's called Table Flipping VIP. So we're going to hear both of those right now. Here's the bass lord, Dave Tipper. Enjoy. We'll be right back. That was Dave Tipper with his latest album, It's Like We Heard, right there, one called Table Flipping VIP, and before that, off of his Forward Escape album in 2014, we heard The Re-Up, and Dave Tipper is from the UK. He has tons of music out there, hundreds and hundreds of songs, a lot of trippy, crazy stuff, unparalleled in the bass world. All right, we are going to move on forward. We're in the second half of the show here tonight, Sync Sound System. Again, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Mara, and I'm here alternating Wednesdays. Lately I've been traveling, however, so we've had other people at the station cover. If you are interested in becoming an airshifter, check the weft.org website for upcoming airshifting training opportunities, and you too can be part of the station. All right, we're going to hear one from an artist called Andralian, and he also has some kind of trippy, skippy beats as well. And we're going to hear this next one called Spartacle from Andralian, formerly known as Heyoka. And going into some more kind of glitchy stuff, we're going to hear Sixus with Awakening World remix. All right, back to the music. Here's Andralian. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Liquid Stranger Dissolve. That was off of Tales of Wakan, just released last year. And Liquid Stranger was Swedish-born, but lives out in Arizona. Before we heard Liquid Stranger, we heard Sixus with Awakening World, the Sixus revisioned version. And if you go to his Bandcamp page, you can hear 6 different remixes of that song. There's one by Expedition, Beatroots, Ecometric, and Bloop. So you can check that out. Awakening World remixes on Bandcamp. That was, again, Sixus, who was also at the Full Moon Gathering with Tipper a few weeks ago in Northern Florida. And then starting off that last set, we also heard that was Andralian with Spartacle. And yeah, that guy is definitely funky fresh too. I've seen him a few times and he keeps it really trippy. All right, we have only enough time for about one more song. One and a half. Let's hear this one from Culprate, the memoirs of Gregory Otterman. And then we'll hear some of this last song by Psilocybin with Stasi. And thanks for listening again to... thanks again for listening to WEFT 90.1 FM and streaming online at weft.org. Tune in Wednesdays 8 to 10, also for Adrian's version of Sync Sound System, more electronic beats, and alternating Wednesdays 9 to 10, second and fourth Wednesdays, that is, with another form of electronic beats. All right. Without further ado, here's Culprate. Thank you.
And thanks to Mara and Sync Sound System. And now it's 9:59, it's 10 o'clock, and you're listening to Not Quite Over the Edge. My name is Barb. I'll be here with